Welcome to Statistical Convergence, the podcast about War Machine, where casual meets hardcore with a side of math. I'm Stussy, and represent the casual part of that catchphrase as well as half the math. You can follow us on Facebook at CO Wargaming to keep up to date on our various projects. My co-host Sung Su will be joining me after the intro music to talk about one of his favorites, Axis, the Harmonic Enforcer. Hey Sung Su, welcome back. How are things going?
It's going great here in the Mile High Meta. Stussy, it's been about a month since we last recorded. What's new in your world?
Well, in a War Machine sense, I set a personal milestone. The week after we recorded, we had a local 11-person tournament. I ended up Ironmanning the Orion list that I talked about on the last episode to a 4-0 win. I had grinding attrition wins versus Fianna 2 and Scar 1, and completely bananas assassination wins against Denny 1 and Nemo 3. By the transitive property of War Machine, I beat at least one national level player, even though I'm fully aware I got lucky at a few spots. The sweetest move of the tournament, I would say, was running a Servitor into melee range of Denny 1 across a wall so that I could shoot it with my own Cypher to land a flare, a magic bullet trigger onto Denny 1, and then the blast damage into her as I shot it with the follow-up with the Cypher in order to kill my Servitor so I could then shoot her to death. How about you, TT? I know you've had at least two big events since the last episode.
Absolutely. As some of you know, 2018 is the year of me traveling to national events. Chronologically, I got fourth in the Las Vegas Open and Champions, scrubbed out in the Masters events. At the Intermountain Cup, I managed to get fifth in Masters, but both events I feel like I learned a lot. More recently, since the last time we recorded, I went to MuseCon playing Convergence. I managed to make the finals and got fourth place, losing to Matt McWaters. 2 weeks ago, I was lucky enough to win Colorado's War Machine Weekend Qualifier with Convergence, the Rocky Mountain Rumble. I'm the first Colorado player to do so, which is almost as exciting as the War Machine Weekend spot itself. So I'm headed in the right direction at least, and it's certainly been a busy month.
That's awesome. Well, since we spent last episode talking about Orion, who is one of my favorites, given your win, I think it's only fair to go into your wheelhouse and give the same treatment to Axis, the Harmonic Enforcer. As we did last time, we'll go over his rules, talk about how he fits into a competitive meta, discuss lists that work well with him, and then go over the weak spots both he and our opponents need to be aware of.
Great, let's get into it. To lay the groundwork for the rest of the show, it's worth taking a few minutes to run through Axis's kit to make sure we don't forget anything and so that everyone's on the same page. Let's start with the front of his card. He's Focus 6, he's Speed 5, Mat 7, Rat 2. That's right, Mat 7, Rat 2. For defensive stats, he's Def 14, Arm 18, with 18 boxes. He feels like a solid caster, not a tank, but definitely not a pushover.
It's kind of funny, given how we were talking about 15-16 on Orion being squishy, just how much difference giving up a point of defense for 2 points of armor makes. Still, there's more going on with Axis, and in particular the sorts of armies he brings that lets him play forward and feel tankier than Orion does.
And even when he does play forward, he has some more tricks to help him stay alive, but more on that later. I do want to remind people right now that Axis is living, just like you and me, which makes a big difference for some of the buffs he can and can't receive in Convergence. He has 2 melee weapons, which remind me of The Rock in The Tooth Fairy. He has hammers named Action and Reaction. He has Beatback, which is every time he hits a model with that. If the model's still there, it can be pushed an inch. Axis immediately follows up. He also has Double Strike, so for every point of focus he spends buying an attack, he actually gets 2 attacks.
It's worth pointing out that his weapons aren't magical. It's an easy assumption to make since the vast majority of casters have magical weapons. Also, it's a little awkward because he's living, so you can't give him the easy magic weapon from the OptiFex directive.
Yet another case where being a robot is better than being alive. Like all Convergence casters, he's a Field Marshal, in this case granting Counter Charge, which is amazing and sometimes horrible at the same time.
I gotta say, he really inflicts what I'll call cognitive load. Most opponents can remember that the counter charge exists, but the demands of being constantly thinking about it is really taxing if they're not used to it. Likewise, the same goes for the player playing Axis as well. At the higher end of play, people have seen this kind of trick before. Karchev pulls basically the same sort of thing. But casually, I think it's one of the big advantages that Convergence has, asking questions that are unusual that people aren't used to thinking about.
For sure, and it's not always just the charge and the charge damage we're happy to get. advancing the countercharge model, getting them up the field to contest or threaten things that previously opponents thought were safe is huge. Remember, it's when engaged, doesn't care if you're engaging. So keep that in mind if people start slamming things, pushing you, bulldoze, and things like that. But way more on that later. His feat, Circumpotence, is a mouthful, and it's incredible. What it says is, for one round, enemy models currently in Axis's control range suffer -2 strength and -2 speed, can't charge, slam, or trample. Friendly faction models gain +2 speed and +2 strength. It's a pretty incredible feat. Off the top of my head, it's definitely a top 10 feat in the game, and for me personally, I always want to ensure I get value out of both sides of that feat, meaning I'm exploiting the fact that I'm giving a negative to my opponents, and I'm benefiting from the bonuses that I'm receiving.
We talked about this with Orion, but this feat is structured the same way in that you want to be getting enemy models in it rather than just yours. This means that he wants to play a little more forward, and you do have to be careful of where you're standing.
Okay, we've worked through most of the front of the card and the back. Stussy, do you want to cover the spells?
I sure will. I gotta say that most of the spell list, the names really feel like they should be read in a monster truck mash reverb effect. So we start with his nuke, Battering Ram. Cost 2, 8-inch range, POW 12. An enemy hit by Battering Ram may be pushed 3 inches directly away from the spell's point of origin. Nukes on a Focus 6 caster are always a little hard to use, but this one does do a lot for just 2 focus. In particular, that static 3-inch push is way more reliable than having to roll dice for distance, which many similar sorts of spells have. His second spell, Iron Aggression, is cost 2, 6-inch range, and an upkeep. Target friendly faction Warjack can run, charge, slam, or trample for free and gains boosted melee attack rolls.
I think one of the things people don't fully utilize a spell is rolling it aggressively into high defense matchup. Axis already grants us mat 7, which is incredible. However, getting 2 vectors a turn to benefit from the mat 7, free charge, slam, trample, and fully boosted melee attacks can be incredible. Keep that in mind when you're setting up your induction vectors.
His third spell on his list is Onslaught. It is cost 2 and an upkeep. It is on himself. The caster and friendly faction models that start their activation in the caster's control range gain relentless charge for one turn, giving them Pathfinder while charging.
Awesome. The one thing I want to say is it does state activation, so you don't receive this on counter charges.
His next spell is Razor Wall, cost 2, and upkeep. Place a wall template anywhere completely within the caster's control range where it does not touch a model, obstruction, or obstacle. Any model entering or ending its activation in the template takes 1 point of damage.
It's a fantastic for board control. Keep scenario in mind as well in keeping models safe. It's a great spell with a lot more depth than you get from initially reading it.
And it's also worth pointing out the combo that comes with his next spell, Unstoppable Force. Cost 2. While within the caster's control range, the battle group gains Bulldoze. Bulldoze being when this model is base-to-base with an enemy model during its normal movement, it can push the enemy model up to 2 inches directly away from it. A model can only be pushed by Bulldoze only once per activation, and has no effect when the model is making a trample power attack.
Obviously, this spell helps make Axis and his army a scenario monster. It's the foundation of the Galv spam list, which Jason Watt has famously heralded to great accomplishments. And it has some cool interactions with slams, where if I have the movement, I bump you, you're bulldozed, I continue my movement, and then I slam you. So you can move a model further than you initially think. It can only be pushed once per activation. But if you have lots of activations, you can ensure you get the pushes you want. The last thing I'll say is it only works when the Jack is in Axis's control range. So keep that in mind. Be sure you don't accidentally shortchange an opponent.
And just as a sense of scale, remember that 2-inch push is basically the diameter of a large base. So if you're working on that scenario play angle, they need to be all the way into the zone or they're risking you just tapping them with a galvanizer to send them out. I'm going to take it as a given that in today's competitive meta, Axis is probably our most competitive caster. Most major tournament winners are running Axis as one half of their list pairs. Starting with Axis himself, TT, what parts of the card make you think of him as a tournament staple?
Well, I'm going to start with what I think is really important and won't be important maybe by the time this podcast comes out, and that's ADR. When this is recorded, Axis is both in Champions and Masters because he's on ADR. This grants flexibility in masters in the form of a Vanguard. Think of it like a Magic the Gathering sideboard. And he's also one of the strongest casters in Season 7 Champions. However, that comes to a grinding halt by the middle of June. The ADR in Masters is going away in Season 8, and he's no longer on the ADR rotation, but it certainly was a feather in his cap for the last 6 months. More than that, when making a pair or deciding on a list, I like to figure out what's the hardest question a faction can ask. Or as Matt McWaters says, what's a sweeper we can get out there? I think Axis may ask the hardest question and the most of them in the faction. He does this a few ways. Bulldoze, which is built for scenario play, spamming cheap, medium-box jacks that can bulldoze, combined with movement-impairing feet, can be a very strong question. Countercharge, like we mentioned in episode 1 about Orion, anytime you can get your opponent thinking or worrying about your models and your activations during their turn is a great thing for you. People will spend more time planning movement and engagements just knowing countercharge is on the table. Aside from that, free swings that could knock models down at mat 7 is really amazing. Also, keep in mind where you countercharge too. I've had plenty of games where people clear a scenario zone, then give me a countercharge and allow me to contest it. Also, keep in mind how far upfield you want to be. Countercharging solely to get upfield additional board presence is monstrous. Lastly, I think his feat is really a game changer. I can't say enough about it. It stops charges, lowers enemy speed and strength, increases friendly speed and strength. So yes, Axis is going to be up the field a little bit. And unlike Orion, though, he has a feat and some defensive abilities to ensure he stays safe. We combine that with the shield guards out of Destruction Initiative, and it's easy to say he's going to be safe even when he's leading his army for a round.
So in Mark II, Axis's claim to fame was built around the fact that his theme force allowed him to bring 4 Enigma Foundries to the table. With the advent of Mark III and theme lists no longer being locked to specific warcasters, where are you looking to go when building a list for him?
Well, let's get some obvious stuff out of the way. He's garbage rat. It drastically reduces the jack selection that I'm willing to consider. Even a fan of the Axiom like you has to admit the Axiom at rat 2 is less than impressive. We have the age-old conversation of Destruction Initiative versus Clockwork Legion. Personally, I've been living in Destruction Initiative, though I do think he is game in Clockwork Legion. The TEP is certainly a popular choice, especially with ADR in the mix.
Yeah, it's worth going back to the conversation we had about the TEP with Orion. The TEP, just on its own, handles offense quite well, and it's usually looking for survivability from the caster. It has relatively short range when shooting, and so it opens itself up to melee counterattacks particularly. A proliferation of countercharges with Axis, as well as Razor Wall, and the defensive applications of Axis's feet all provide a lot of that protection that the TEP wants. Axis is one of the few places I'd consider a TEP almost automatic, and would even consider playing too.
For someone who's played the faction since release, you sure are unexcited about one of our flagship models. So what's up with the TEP?
TEP time. So part of the reason I don't like the TEP as much as many other people is I tend to be pretty risk averse when I'm planning my turn. When staring at the board and trying to figure out what's going where and attacks I'm making, I try to plan around what the TEP will do. Whereas my opponent, when evaluating the board, has to worry about what the TEP might do. And given the number of dice that it rolls, there's a pretty wide spread there. I've seen many players talk about the possibilities of spiking dice like it's a good thing, but it's worth remembering it works both upwards and downwards. Most players are very familiar with how to calculate the mean, or average. 1d6 has an average roll of 3.5, and you can add these together for multiple dice. At the risk of sounding like a probability and statistics class, I want to add another number to the mix. The variance. Variance is a number that describes how swingy the results are around that mean. 1d6 has a variance of 2.9, and when you roll multiple dice, you can add these together. To turn it into something that you can use more directly, though, you want to take the square root of that number to get the standard deviation, which for most dice distributions, plus or minus one standard deviation will encompass 68% of all total results. Put another way, if the number you need to reach to kill your target is one standard deviation above the mean, you've only got a 16% chance of success.
So what you're saying is instead of using average dice and counting on it, you're saying we should calculate its variance to give us a spread so we can bank on predictable damage instead of average damage? How can this help us on the table?
I'll just throw out an example here. Let's say you've got the TEP shooting twice at 46 damage. That's 8d6 total. 8 times that 2.9 of variance will be a total of about 23. And the square root of that will be a standard deviation of just under 5. So let's say I'm shooting at a target and the average would be 20 damage. This would be about right for shooting light beasts, jacks, or multi-wound infantry. Going in knowing that 20 damage and the standard deviation of 5, I will plan for doing about 15. For a sense of scale, this is kind of like planning around rolling a 5 for damage on 2d6 or a 7 on 3d6, which might be a little pessimistic, but if this is the only attacks you're putting on target with a key piece in your army, you want to be prepared and be planning around what happens if this goes wrong. It's worth saying that if you're doing these kind of calculations, they really work best if you sum all the dice together to find the variance and then work out the standard deviation. As you increase the number of dice you roll, the standard deviation increases, but not as fast as the number of dice. If you're relying on fistfuls of dice to get work done, you want to be prepared.
No, that's a great piece of information, and hopefully some people can take that to the table with them. Do you have any specific lists you're running with Axes? Recently, I've been running 3 inverters, a cipher, a single TEP, a diffuser, 2 galvanizers, and servitors and taste. Please keep in mind also I have ADR here, which has a second TEP and an additional heavy.
Given as ADR may be gone by the time this episode comes out, if you're playing him off ADR in Masters, what route would you choose to go with him?
Well, the one I'm excited about testing is something like this. Axes, a cipher, corollary, diffuser, 8 galvanizers, 2 inverters, servitors to taste, and an optifix directive, which means no TEP. So I'm going to threaten that in my off list. If I end up in Clockwork Legions as my off list, I'm going to try to get a TEP into the Axis list, but that's a lot of testing and a lot of games away.
When I've been playing with him, I've been tinkering with him in Clockwork Legion, kind of out of a desire to be a special snowflake, and also because I don't own the multiplicity of specific vectors to make the Destruction Initiative lists work. 8 galvanizers? I consider most Destruction Initiative lists to start with 4 Enigma Foundries. I then go with a full unit of Obstructors and a full unit of Reductors, 3 units of Clockwork Angels, and a full unit of Reciprocators. Round that out, spending my jack points with 2 Conservators, a Corollary, and 2 galvanizers.
So I'm going to interrupt you for a minute there, Stussy. You poke a little fun at me for owning 17 galvanizers, but you know what I don't own? 3 units of Clockwork Angels. I just don't understand your love of them. Assuming the limitations of what you do and do not own was removed, would you still be running these?
If model concerns weren't an issue, I think I would probably cut the reciprocators. They're solid, but their inclusion is primarily because the army list was built first with Lucant in mind, who really works better with them. If I could swap them for another unit of obstructors, that would free up a few points to vary the jack package a bit while still giving me that forward shield wall capable reach melee presence. I think the angels stay in, though. I won't lie, I do love the models, but they do a lot for the list. Since Clockwork Legions can't bring the TEP, the angels provide the ability for a little bit of interaction at range before things close to melee. While I feel they are overpriced for what they do, their speed makes them much easier to put on target than something like a second unit of reductors, which is what I think they're generally replacing. The Clockwork Angels they're not an attacking unit. What they're there for is that they are fast. Between the AD and the speed, and the speed 7 and flight, they're as much about jamming as they are threatening things. Sure, you can play them as the hard flankers, but they're going to lose to anything else that's going way out on the wings that's really going to seriously contest them. But they give you something that can be way up the board on turn 1, as well as your Enigma Foundry still having them in recursion range. Secondly, they have the advantage of they are a unit, even if they're only down to 1 member. So you can always hold one back to try and use souls, be they from Clockwork Angels or from Obstructors, to try and bring the unit back, and they're great for scoring late in the game.
I certainly understand what you're saying, and I'll hold final judgment till I get them on the table a little bit myself. While I agree you can have them very far forward and still in the Enigma Foundry range, how is the Enigma Foundry going to recur them? The Enigma Foundry can only drop models within 3 inches of itself, which then has to be in formation and within 3 inches of another model. I definitely think you can jam with them the same way you can jam with Reflex Servitors or any other servitor. However, those servitors are free, and even if I paid for them, they are cheaper than the Clockwork Angels. while I'm not saying they're bad, so many things in this game are literally just a determination of their points. Any model in this game, if given a good, aggressive pricing structure, could be good. I personally feel like the Angels simply don't have that.
And I'm not going to disagree. I feel that they are a little overcosted for what they do, but in Clockwork Legions, you can't bring servitors, and so in terms of having something fast to contest with and to get up there, this is what you're left with.
Okay, that's enough about the Angels for now. How do you feel about the list's general performance?
Just coming from having been playing Orion most recently in Destruction Initiative, I really miss the Attunement servitors, in particular as mat fixers. I found the reductors are hard to use. That 6-inch range is really short, particularly when they're behind a wall of other units. The changes to recursion between Mark II and Mark III, where models brought back can't attack, is really rough for them. And getting meaningful attacks in is hard, especially because it's almost impossible to ever get the aiming bonus. All that said, the list is definitely doing something powerful. I've not had a very good track record with it, but a lot of that comes down to pilot error and deliberately pushing boundaries to see how much I can get away with. Speaking of pilot error, Axis sure does seem like he has a big learning curve and has a suite of skills that are fairly specific to him.
Yeah, he's got a few positioning things in particular that come to mind. The first is induction chains. And before you tell me I play Convergence, I already have the induction chains mastered, I'll remind you about counter charge. Models are going to move, hopefully, by the time you end your turn and by the time your next turn begins. And one more tip on countercharging when we're there is don't be afraid to countercharge additional models that aren't going to get into melee. One example I'll give, if you move up, let's say, a Clockwork Angel, I'm going to countercharge it with a Galvanizer. Let's pretend the Galvanizer doesn't kill the Angel. I might countercharge more Galvanizers to get the movement, set myself up for a better induction change, even though those Galvanizers might hit my own Galvanizer's base, preventing it from making it into melee. Another thing with Axis is I try really hard to defeat by turn 3. Now, before you go out there and lose a game because you said TT told you to feed on turn 3, look at the board, read the board, and make the best decision for your game. Against anything that has decent boxes or armor, you want to be sure you're getting as much value as possible from that +2 strength swing. And like we said before, I really want to maximize the negative the opponent receives and the positive my army receives.
I gotta admit, that's counterintuitive for me. I've always subscribed to feed early, feed often, when you can get the most number of models affected by it. And that's true offensively or defensively. Since he's such a scenario-based caster, do you actually look at what scenario is on the table when choosing which list to play? Are there ones he really doesn't want to play, or ones that he's so good at that you'd consider dropping him even into a bad or awkward matchup?
I mean, Axis doesn't have a ton of bad matchups. Right now in SR 2017, I'll play Axis into every scenario. In the Pokemon list building terms, Axis can be a pivot, which means he asks more than one hard question. Yes, he can be a scenario monster, but he can also slug it out. He can grind it out on attrition. There are ones he loves, and there are ones he loves less. Breakdown and Outlast, which are the ones with the two circle zones, he's not a huge fan of, as he finds himself with only himself and the Optifix directive in my personal list to score those giant circles. But that's more Destruction Initiative hate than necessarily Axis himself.
So if he does have awkward matchups, and you mentioned there are not that many of them, what are they?
Well, Axis into Dark to Arcadius is a headache in the game. But right now, what I'm trying to learn is Axis into Gatsby 3 Slayer spam. For those of you who don't know, it's basically 9 Slayers, Gatsby 3, Ironmongers, Machine Wraith, and a Soul Trapper. And before you think that that's an easy slam dunk, I encourage you to get some real playtime against it on the table.
Slayers? 9 Slayers? Slayers used to be a joke. You could get them for $5 from everyone who had grabbed a Crix starter box for Denny and the Bone Jacks.
I think I bought a $5 Slayer off you way back in the day. But let me tell you about Black Industries. Field Marshal and Yielding, and Mobility. Basically, it means that 10-point Slayer ends up with a 13-19 defensive stat line against melee, or a 13-21 defensive stat line against range. Which brings up an interesting subject. I've been taking the TEPs out versus Gatsby 3 Slayers. Boy, I'll really miss it when ADR is gone. But the math of an inverter to kill a Slayer was something I found really interesting personally. You want to walk everyone through it?
So I'm going to start with the simplest case of an inverter just walking into melee and starting swinging. You need to evaluate, basically, do you want to boost the initial to hit roll? If you boost the macro pummeler, you've got 95% to hit, and then with the meteor hammer initial plus two more bot attacks, you've got 18% to cause enough damage to get the kill. I'm going to loop back to the previous discussion we had about variance. Right now, I've got the luxury of a spreadsheet in front of me to help with these calculations, but if I'm trying to figure this out after the game on the bus or while on a run, even I wouldn't try to do this at the table. It'd look something like this. The macro pummeler is going to do 2d6 plus 1 damage against the arm 19, and then the meteor hammer does 3 more attacks at 2d6 minus 2 each. Lump it all together, I'm looking at 8d6 minus 5, looking for a total of 28, so a die roll of 33. I know the average on 8d6 is 28, that's 3.5 times 8, which I simplified to 7 times 4 in my head. That means to roll 33, I need to be 5 over the mean here. The variance on 8d6 would be 2.9 times 8, let's call it 23. 5 squared is 25, so the square root of 23 would be just a bit lower than 5. That means I need to do a bit better than one standard deviation over the mean, which is in the ballpark of 16 to 17%. So boosting the to hit, we're looking at a total of about 17% to scrap. That's the 95% to hit times the 18% to cause enough damage. If we don't boost that initial hit, it's only 72% to get the knockdown, but the additional bot attack pushes your chance to do enough damage if the knockdown hits up to 54%. Remember, this is dice off 2, so an average of 5, which we worked out before was how much we needed to beat the mean by in order to get the kill. So it shouldn't surprise us that adding another attack puts us right on the cusp of 50-50 for killing if we get the first hit. Composite total, if you don't boost the initial hit, 39%.
Okay. So, without anything else on the board, it's better not to boost the hit looking for the knockdown. What if we throw Iron Aggression into the mix?
Iron Aggression is a game changer, hugely here. It's giving us two things over the unboosted case specifically, where you had a 39% chance. You upgrade your chance of hitting with the macro pummeler from 72% to 95% on the to-hit roll. And you get an additional die of damage because you can probably finagle taking advantage of that free charge. Total chance, you end up at about 72%, almost twice the best case without it.
Okay, and as we mentioned earlier, I love to double dip in that feat. I want those Slayers to be minus 2 speed and strength, and I want my inverters going at a plus 2 speed and strength. What happens if we toss that into the mix?
It's actually a pretty simple change. The feat is adding 8 to 10 static damage depending upon whether you're boosting that initial hit or not. Remember that we worked out our standard deviation of 5 for 8d6? This is an improvement of nearly 1.6 standard deviations. So we go from needing to be one standard deviation above the mean to being able to afford half a standard deviation below the mean. This gives you a total chance to kill if you boost of 73%, 70% if you don't, and like 95% if you have Iron Aggression up.
So summary, the armor swing is super powerful. Iron Aggression is a game changer. However, if you're not using either of those, we shouldn't be looking to boost that knockdown. I do want to add in the calculation we did for adding the feat to our damage, where it dramatically changed our chances to kill. That's the main reason I want to double dip on the feat for axes. You can think of it as plus 2 armor if you catch everything that's going to be hitting their models. Plus 2 armor plus 2 strength, it's a huge feat.
So, do you feel that there's an issue with Axis if he gets locked into attrition gameplay? Countercharge is certainly good, but outside of the feat turn, I sort of wonder if he's kind of pillow fisted, and your plan A of going on scenario sure seems like it's prone to trading pieces awkwardly.
So much depends on the list. Most attrition games I'm okay playing into. If you think of the list I'm testing, I mentioned 8 galvanizers. So while I'm going to give an opponent an alpha, I'm hopefully not giving him an alpha into my heavy hitters, being the Cypher or the Inverters. The feat should allow me to control the alpha and mitigate the swingback. Countercharge is always free attacks, and in long attrition games, a caster who can get worked on themselves is highly desirable, and Axis certainly can do that.
So if I had to summarize Axis is a strong tournament caster who has a kit that works really well in a scenario environment defined by standing in zones and on flags. His signature abilities are giving bulldoze to his warjacks, granting mass countercharge to all those jacks, and having an extremely potent feat that you really want to try and hold until you can benefit from both halves of it, unless you need to use it early to survive. Destruction Initiative lets him bring stuff that plays to all those strengths. Lots of jacks to leverage his power abilities, free servitors that provide protection and solos for scenario play, and it lets him bring Teps to provide a potent ranged threat in a list that would otherwise not have it.
I wholeheartedly agree. I think he's Converged's strongest sweeper and possibly our best pivot. He's incredibly fun and dynamic to play, with a super high ceiling. The amount of tools he has and the fits he can cause opponents make him ridiculously strong in the current steamroller scenarios. I feel like we could go on for hours talking about Axis, but I think it's about time to wrap this up.
I'm going to stick in here. I have found he's a little awkward for super casual play for two reasons. One, he's complicated, and getting used to working around his particular issues that TT has mentioned, such as knowing how to play countercharge, the induction chains, and how to best use the feat, are skills that are pretty unique to him and not easily transferable from other Convergence casters. If you're willing to make the commitment to him, that's not really an issue, but don't expect picking him up to be easy. Secondly, because his kit is so unique and so key to what steamroller scenarios want, he can be awkward to play against someone who is new or doesn't have a ton of opportunity to play. I don't hear a lot of War Machine players talk about this, but if you're new and up against this kind of list, you can very easily lose without fully understanding why, and it can be a rough experience. If you find yourself as a veteran Axis player against someone new, be ready to help and walk them through your game plan and how they might be able to interact with it, if they're okay with that idea. Or the game may end up being unsatisfying for you both.
Those are great, valid points, and I see the former press ganger in you. I think any of the deeper casters in the game take a little longer to spin up with, and yes, any of the top of the pile casters, which I'm going to consider Axis in, is going to be way less fun to play against as a new player. As that experienced Axis player, let's try to grow your meta, let's try to ensure that even if you win, your opponent doesn't feel helpless and has some things to work on and can get better so you can get a better game next time.
So hey TT, I know you've been busy recently, but did you get a chance to try that challenge I gave you last episode, taking Orion out but dropping the two assimilators for three modulators, and to see how you felt about relying on more bodies and shots and fewer ground pounders?
I did. A whole one game with it. Sorry guys, but I've been pretty busy with MuseCon and the Rocky Mountain Rumble. I didn't have a lot of time for the challenges. I was able to win my game, though, and I'd certainly benefit from a lot of shots the game has into infantry spam. I'm not sure I'd love it into armor, but we'll need a game or possibly two to figure out if I really like it. Speaking of which, when we're done here, it's going to be game night, and I promise I'll play it again tonight. So Stussy, I've been thinking a lot about your Clockwork Legions list, and I have a challenge for you. It's a bit of a two-parter. I'll put max FA Clockwork Angels into my Legions list, if you'll drop yours from your list. Anybody listening, if you have thoughts on the Angels, just reverse those thoughts for this challenge. Next recording, let's meet up, and maybe we'll see the other's point of view a little bit clearer.
And that wraps up our second episode of Statistical Convergence on Axis the Harmonic Enforcer. Be sure to follow us on Facebook at CO Wargaming, and you can follow TT's Mad Shenanigans on Twitter at Tsung Tsu, TSEUNGTSU. We'd love to hear your ideas for future content that you want to hear, be it Convergence-related or not. Special thanks to Muse on Minis for hosting us, and Beat Bop Buzz on Instagram for providing us our intro music. Keep your ear to the ground for our next episode, which will be coming out in July featuring the new caster, Athanor Locke. Until then, keep running those numbers.
I literally thought, I said the same thing when you're like, yeah, we just take the stay root of the, and I'm like, okay, how many people did we just lose?